I'm Bill Ault. Welcome to Northern Latitudes. Trina Moyles is a Yukon-based author, journalist, and a creative producer. Her work is inspired by rural communities and relationships with land, wildlife, food security, and climate change. Moyles' articles and essays have also been published extensively in North America. We spoke about her life as a lookout, the politics of wildfires, and how her life has changed since leaving the lookout world.
So my name is Trina Moyles. I'm an author and journalist. I'm living in Whitehorse, Yukon Territory. I'm the author of two nonfiction books. My first book was called Women Who Dig, Farming, Feminism, and the Fight to Feed the World. That book came out in 2018, and it's about my travels to 8 different countries asking women about what it means to farm and the challenges that they're facing and different ways that they're growing food and stewarding animals to overcome those challenges to feed their communities. And my second book was about a memoir called Lookout, Love, Solitude, and Searching for Wildfire in the Boreal Forest, which came out in 2021. And that book is about my experience as a wildfire lookout in Northern Alberta. I worked 7 seasons as a wildfire lookout. And then I'm also working on a third book, which is called Black Bear. And that book is coming out in the summer of 2025. And that book sort of tags on to my experiences as a lookout. And it's learning to live in this really amazing Black Bear corridor in Northern Alberta. So it's a book about human-bear coexistence and told through a personal lens of sort of a trial and error, what to do, what not to do, of learning to live with black bears.
And this book, Lookout, is which we're going to start talking with today, is a very personal, and it's not just about the relationship between you and nature. It's a relationship about relationships, and it's a very personal memoir. What made you decide that you wanted to write such a personal memoir?
I think it wasn't obvious to me when I first started working on the idea for the book. I actually saw it as being more sort of traditional nonfiction writing or journalism, literary journalism, of thinking outside of my own experience. I was really fascinated by this community that I had stepped into as a fire tower lookout, especially in my first couple of seasons. Like my neighbors around me, we call them neighbors, even though people are working, you know, maybe at towers that are like 50 to 100 to 200, you know, kilometers away from you. So you're not right next door to them. Yet as the season goes on, when you hear their voice on the radio every single day, you know, you start to feel very connected to these people because you're sharing in this, you know, very niche thing that you're doing on the landscape of, you know, watching for wildfires and, you know, managing yourself when you're living alone in a cabin in the bush for like 4 to 5 months every year. And many of these people come back to the job, you know, year after year. We call them lifers. So I was really fascinated in their stories of like, who are these people? Like, what motivates a person to live alone in the forest and do this? And, you know, in doing so, you're sort of sacrificing this other part of yourself on the outside world, you know? So who are these people? What are their stories? And as I was working on this, I realized, you know, the ironic thing about it is it's like, what has motivated me to choose the same lifestyle? Why am I doing this? What was my life before? And so the book actually just naturally became more and more personal. I think in the second year that I was working on it, I realized it's a bit of a, you know, when you're asking other people these questions, it's sort of like not an avoidance, but I realized like being a lookout is a very internal experience. You're alone with yourself at the tower. So in a way you can be your own best friend. You can be your own worst enemy. And you have to spend a lot of time thinking about your own story inevitably with all that time in the bush. And so I think it just felt like the more honest story was to tell my personal story and to really, you know, try and hold nothing back. Like, why am I really here? What led me here? And, you know, and what sort of internal challenges did I face out at the tower? So I think just that, like, naturally it became a memoir. It seemed like the most honest story I could tell about the experience of being a lookout, I think.
And you talk about lifers, and in the book you talk about, I don't want to call it the fear of becoming a lifer, but the challenge and the of not of separating yourself too much from modern civilization. And it was a balancing act that you were starting to worry that the balancing was, you were starting to become a lifer yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember in like one of my last years, one of the lifers had said to me, you know, you don't want to do this job longer than 5 years because you lose your sense of relevancy in the world. And that really startled me because, and I really had to think about what she meant by that, you know, and I think this is actually very rarely spoken about with lookouts, but it is true. It's this massive sacrifice because you're essentially spending half the year alone in the woods watching for wildfire, and you get really good at it. And people like really some, it's really a job that's suited for some people. Like you, I mean, I really started to love it, as the lifers obviously love it. You know, you feel this like strong sort of even like natural sense of being called back every spring when you start to see, you know, the earliest signs of green up, or you see like the cumulus nimbus clouds starting to build in the sky again, which doesn't really happen over the winter. You know, you start to see these cues of fire season. You literally feel like as if you're a migratory bird, like called back to your lookout. And it's hard to explain, but you do feel such a sense of community out there, though you are alone. You know, I don't think I've ever had any other experience in my life where I felt like I knew exactly where I was supposed to be, which, you know, and then it's tough though, because then you know, when the fire season wraps up, you have to navigate back into civilization and this like really different way of life. And I sort of struggled with that every off season. A lot of fire personnel will start to feel this sense of like loneliness actually when they re-enter society, not just the lookouts, but also the firefighters too. It can be a hard social thing to navigate. And I did decide to hang up my hat after my seventh season, which was 2022. And so, yeah, I think what that woman was saying to me, it's not that you lose your sense of relevancy in the world. It's just that it becomes that much more difficult to reintegrate into society after X amount of seasons, you know? So it's it can be a tricky thing. And I feel like it's kind of the untold story with lookouts, is like, not what does it mean to be at the lookout, but what does it mean to be a lookout and then reintegrating into society? And it's really not easy. Although I am happy I made that personal decision. But it has definitely been a bit of a transition point in my life, I think.
And I know you wrote an article dealing with the psychological challenges that the lookouts and the firefighters face all the time, and certainly off season and in season now. What's changed over the last few years for these people that do this kind of work?
Yeah, it's in some ways, I don't want to say nothing has changed, because I think we are in a new fire paradigm now. But some things are similar. Like, I mean, there's a lot of, it's interesting being on the outside of, or like being away from the frontline experience of wildfire and sort of being closer to everyday, you know, people reactions to what's happening with these fires. I think there's some myths, like, for example, people are saying right now, I mean, there's a fire that blew up outside of Fort Nelson. It was a holdover fire, meaning that was a fire that started last season and burnt over the winter, which is actually pretty normal. Like these holdover fires, that's what they do. They sort of burn deep in the peat and then they can reawaken in the spring when the conditions are there. And these spring fires have always existed on the landscape. It's actually typically when, speaking for Alberta anyways, when Alberta tends to get their biggest, kind of scariest fires that could threaten communities, it's typically in this window of time between when, you know, the snow melts and before the trees green up. And so that's a really dry, it's a time where there's a lot of dry fuels on the landscape. So it's a pretty common time for these fires to ignite. Fort McMurray fire started in May of 2016. The Chuck Egg fire started similarly in early May of 2019. The Slave Lake fire from 2011 also started in early May. And so it's interesting. In some ways, things have not changed, but what we are seeing is there's, you know, the frequency of these big fires igniting, that is increasing. And so, you know, are we looking at every wildfire season, we're going to be experiencing larger fires. So I think from a frontline perspective, like the article that you're referring to, I was trying to communicate that. I mean, previously, you know, wildfire fighters would have very intense seasons, and then it would sort of be balanced out by like slower seasons. Now we're finding, you know, with climate change and you know, extreme weather patterns sort of driving, you know, like the drought we experienced over the winter, like, you know, these extreme weather patterns driving fires, we're starting to see, you know, like, well, suddenly, you know, the frontline workers are, every season is a crazy season where they're working really long hours, where there's this, like, you know, the threat of fire is so imminent in the mind. And that really starts to build in the frontline experience. And that can be, you know, it cause a lot of burnouts. There's a lot of people talking about burnout right now. And, you know, are frontline workers getting the adequate, like, sort of social and mental supports that they need to endure this? It's really, it can be really tough, and it's really draining, you know? So I think, yeah, I think what has changed is now it's just the unpredictability. It's just, we don't know what kind of fire season we're going to get. And it does seem like, you know, we're getting these big fires like every single season, as opposed to maybe every 5 years or every 7 years.
Has there been other factors that have contributed outside of climate change to the paradigm shift, as you called it?
I think there's more people on the landscape recreating than ever before. There's more people building their homes in the boreal forest. So as the population increases in the boreal forest, that sort of interface between communities and wildfires, that has also increased. And people are the cause of very many wildfires. You know, that's from, you know, indirect causes, like, for example, power line fire, high winds. You know, that's a common way for a fire to start, as the winds blow down the power line and the power line ignites a fire. Or it could be something more direct and hands-on, like someone driving their ATV or quad through the bush, and, you know, and there's like really dry grass that ignites. That was the cause of the Fort McMurray wildfire in 2016. So I think it's a combination of both. You know, we have never been on the landscape the way that we are today. You know, there's more people than ever recreating and living in the space where these fires can ignite.
And what about management? The management, not so much of the fires themselves, but what's the management of the forest as opposed to how it was done, you know, 100 years ago, as opposed to what we've been doing the last 100 years? I know you've written a really nice article on the indigenous approach to this and how we got away from that. And that, is that contributing as well to what we're seeing today?
Oh, absolutely. For the Alberta Views magazine article that I wrote, I interviewed a really amazing person in Canada's in the wildfire community, Dr. Amy Cardinal Christensen, and she is a Métis member from Northern Alberta, and she has studied and written extensively on the use of cultural fire on the landscape. So many different Indigenous and First Nations communities across Canada used to use, or still do today, but like from a historic perspective, used wildfire as this cultural burning, as this way of cleansing a landscape of debris, of being able to stimulate berry growth or to attract ungulates back to an area. And they did this during, you know, windows of time when the conditions for big fires happening was very, very low. So typically, you know, like early spring when the conditions are still very wet, or late fall when things are quite cool and damp. And, you know, and fire was, you know, fire belongs in the boreal forest. Something that really changed my mind was when I read a book by Cordy Timstra called The Chinchaga Firestorm. And he's, one of the lines in his book says, fire is as natural in the boreal forest as rain is in the Amazon. And that really reminded me, like, fire has always lived through the boreal forest. It's when you think about the trees in the boreal forest, you know, like a lot of the coniferous species, they're literally designed to burn. Their cones are at the top of the trees. And the way those cones open and regenerate is through fire, through high heat. So the forest is designed to burn. That some fire on the landscape is actually quite healthy. And what happened historically in Canada through colonization is that these Indigenous groups that were practicing cultural burning, their practices were literally outlawed and criminalized. Like, people would be put in jail for, you know, cleansing the landscape in the way that the forest actually really needs. Folks like Dr. Amy Cardinal Christensen are bringing, you know, are really promoting the use of these practices in communities and, you know, and advocating for putting fire back into the hands of First Nations communities who are disproportionately impacted by the wildfire crisis that we're seeing today. So it just really makes sense that how do we use fire as a responsible way on the landscape? And I think First Nations communities are really at, you know, like their elders are the ones who are guiding these processes and we can really learn from right now, because some fire on the landscape is good fire, as Amy calls it.
It's one of those things where we look on it and it seems to be a fairly simple, at least not a solution, but a simple step to take. Why do you think it hasn't? Why do you think it just doesn't happen that we don't revert to some of these older ways that make sense?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think people are afraid of fire. I actually, it's, you know, not no longer being a frontline worker and being closer to these perspectives, like, yeah, I can see how people are really terrified of fire, and fire is really misunderstood in a lot of ways. Like I live up in the Yukon now, and last summer, for example, one of my neighbors said, you know, oh, there was a fire that ignited. It's like, we really got to keep an eye. It's, you know, and I said, oh, okay, like how, you know, and there was a tinge of smoke in the air, but just barely. And people who work in fire get used to, like, you know, really thick smoke in the air. And so I said, how close is the fire? And she says, oh, it's like 80 kilometers away. And I just kind of like, I didn't laugh, but I was like, wow, like that fire is not a risk to us at all, you know? And I think there's just really this, like, this lack of understanding from the public about wildfire. So that's part of it. People are really afraid, and they have every right to be afraid, because who wants to lose their home or their community to a wildfire? It would be such a traumatic thing to experience, and communities are experiencing it. So I do understand that fear. So a lot of it, I think, is it comes down to politics. Like, for example, when I first started as a wildfire lookout in 2016, they actually were doing more prescribed burns on the landscape. And a prescribed burn is different from cultural burning. I do want to point that out. And Amy often points that out too. They're not quite the same thing. Prescribed fires are, you know, like they have a lot of wildfire personnel on hand to make sure that fire doesn't jump, which is smart. But I mean, the difference is those fires do burn really hot and quite intense, versus the Indigenous method is actually like very, very, very in cool, cool, cool conditions. And so like much smaller scale fires as well. So it's different. Both, I think, are important and have a role to play. But I remember before one of the provincial elections, they actually canceled one of the prescribed burns. And so that tells you, like, people don't want to gamble with these prescribed burns, because it makes politicians look really bad if something jumps or if something goes wrong. And things do go wrong because, you know, mistakes are made, or, you know, Mother Nature has other plans. So like fires do jump, even prescribed fires. So I think there's sort of this like lack of political will to really invest in prescribed fires on the landscape. I didn't hear anything from Alberta politicians about the use of prescribed fires. And when we're thinking about the 2023 season, instead, they're talking about, you know, using like night helicopters and, you know, and investing in technology to fight fires. So that should tell us something. I think there's a political reluctance to rely on prescribed fires, even though we know they work and that they can actually protect communities. If you look at communities where there's prescribed fires done around them, and then there are these dangerous fires, like that can really slow down a fire. That could really save a community, as if we did more prescribed burns. But there's such a lack of political will to make it happen. That's just my two cents.
Yeah, well, your two cents. I wasn't going to bring politics into it, but now you've done it, so it's fair for us to talk about politics.
Well, fire is political. It's very political.
It is really political. And until I read a few of your articles, I didn't realize how much of a political thing. And I mean, it's different here in the East, right? Because especially in my part of the East, we don't have forest fires like you do out West. To see how political it is in Alberta, and especially when you see some of the things, some of the decisions made politically about forest fires, especially after what happened last year, you kind of go like, what were they thinking and why would they make this decision? And then you realize it's mostly a political decision.
Yeah. I mean, something that really threw me last season, this is just, you know, again, like I was working as a journalist last summer. So I was writing more about what I was seeing versus like being in it. And then that was a really cool place to be, because I do understand the frontline experience, and I had access to a lot of frontline workers who wanted to speak to me, and they had to speak to me anonymously. because, you know, they're at risk of losing their job to say something that, you know, appears that it's criticizing Alberta wildfire, even though most folks weren't really criticizing Alberta wildfire. It was sort of the politics governing Alberta wildfire and the massive cutbacks that have happened over the years. You know, the ironic thing is, like, our fires have never been more dangerous, and yet the budget has never been as small as it is today. So, and, you know, we've never had as many values at risk on the landscape, like different human values on the landscape, including industry. And yet the budget, wildfire budget, has never been as small as it is today. So, and something that really threw me last year was when Danielle Smith, you know, was, you know, really incited the sense of, like, well, it's the arsonists are to blame. And it's like, man, talk about a brilliant political distraction, because, I mean, arson has always been a part of wildfires on the landscape. It just, it sort of is. I mean, people who work in wildfire know this. Some of the fires, yes, are lit by arsonists. It's a very small percentage. When you think about all the other human ways where wildfires are ignited, and, you know, speaking about the power line fires, or, you know, or trains cause fires as well. Like, it's, there's lots of causes that are, you know, accidental and not, you know, they're not the cause of arson. You know, these evil people out in the bush, like, looking to light fires, they do exist, but, like, a very, very, very small percentage. So to me, this whole conversation was just really a waste of time. It was like such a political distraction from the point that, you know, that government had made massive cutbacks. They didn't have firefighters ready to fight these fires when they blew up in late April last year. You know, like, there's never been, you know, they have wildfire managers who really have the skills to manage these big fires. And they were working, like, 7 to 8 crazy long shifts. These are, like, 2 to 3 week deployments through the summer. People are super burnt out, you know, crying for money, crying for more resources. So to me, the arson thing was just this brilliant political distraction on her part, so people didn't have to look at the facts, which was that, you know, they weren't ready. They weren't ready, and they had left communities vulnerable. So that was, it was disheartening and quite frustrating.
Your relationship with nature goes way back. When you read your book, Look Out, you realize it started when you were young, and then you got into other things, and I won't give it away because it's a very important part of the book. And then you came back, and a lot of people do this. I mean, we go away and we come back to where we came from. How did your relationship as a lookout and your relationship as a lookout with nature, how did it change once again, and relationship with fire? Because obviously fire has become, I don't want to say more important to you, but it's certainly become part of your journalism in your time after being a lookout. So how did that whole relationship change, and or did it change for you with nature and in relationship to fire?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, and it's true, that is such a common narrative of going away, of leaving a space that you grew up in and then coming back to it and maybe seeing it with different eyes. And I think that was true. That was true for me. And my first season alone in the bush, I think I realized how ill-equipped I was. You know, I had always thought of myself as someone who had grown up in nature. You know, my dad was a wildlife biologist. We did a lot of camping, and, you know, my brother and I hunted grouse together. Like, we spent a lot of time on the land. But I think there's a difference between being on the land and being with the land. And when, you know, and being a lookout, it's a really privileged position to spend such a concentrated amount of time in nature. So that my relationship with nature definitely changed. It definitely deepened. And it also made me realize how afraid I was of certain things. And it's, I think, because I didn't understand, you know, like, I didn't understand, say, I'm writing a lot about this right now with my next book, Black Bear. And I think there's a strong parallel between bears and fires, because we're afraid of both of them. They're both seen as these predator forces. It's ultimately because we don't understand them, though. And so I remember my first season, I said, oh, I don't want to see a wildfire. Like, the last thing I want to do is call in a fire, even though that was my job, is, like, to call in smokes, right? But I was so terrified of the premise of it because I didn't understand it. And then it turned out the first fire I saw was actually just this, like, incredible thrill to be a part of this, you know, system of reporting smoke. And then, you know, the firefighting crew going out and being able to, like, you know, manage that fire and make decisions about that fire, knowing that stemmed from my judgment, was such a cool thing. And I actually grew to, like, really love seeing fires, certain fires, I should say, because there were some fires I saw that were very terrifying, and that was a different relationship with fire, obviously. But yeah, I think I really softened into the experience, and it's very humbling, you know, learning from both fire and from being in the bush, and learning how to, like, you know, negotiate space with, you know, predator species like black bears and grizzly bears. It's really humbling, and you have to check yourself a lot. And I think you make very many mistakes, and you question your assumptions that you came into that experience with too. So for me, it was a deepening. And that is, I think, one of the most unique opportunities of being a lookout, is you get to have these incredible relationships with different wildlife species and being in nature. And, you know, my one friend who worked 14 seasons as a wildfire lookout, she said, you know, at the beginning of every season, I think it takes like about 2 weeks for the bush to finally accept you again, you know, because it's true, because you come into the experience with, like, you know, being such this like sort of city or town busybody, and you really have to change your energy, I think, and you change your sense of pace and urgency out there. So it's a pretty profound experience, and I feel really lucky that I got to have that. But it's a deepening. You learn to, when you emerge from the experience of being a lookout, I think you do look at like natural phenomena differently. You look at things differently. I think my sense of observation of the natural world has deepened so much. And maybe that's one of the challenging things now of not being in the bush in the same way, is like how to cultivate those relationships when you are no longer in that space where you're sort of uninterrupted concentration on the natural world. You know, I have to go into town a lot more often now. So it's it's kind of messed with that sense, I think, but I'm just trying to figure that out now.
Well, it's interesting, because that was going to be my next question, was how is that relationship carried on now that you have, quote unquote, returned to civilization? Is it different in that it's not as deep, or is it different in that it just doesn't happen as often as it used to?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, some people would look at my life on the map and say, well, you live in, you know, you live in Whitehorse, Yukon territory. There's a whole lot of bush up here. The other day, I think I posted something on my Instagram that was like, I was like along the Yukon, I live beside the Yukon River, and it's so beautiful. It's just been so beautiful to kind of watch the, you know, the ice, you know, break up, and the trumpeter swans came and they landed here. They were here while there was that, you know, that sort of ice edge effect, and, you know, like grubbing or whatever, like looking for the vegetation. And so it's been really beautiful to observe that too. But I wrote, like, I was like, oh, this river is lovely, but I'm missing the real bush. And then I like checked myself, and I was like, what do I even mean by the real bush? Like, what does that mean? You know, I think maybe I was talking about that like deep immersion, you know, that the lookout experience offers. And it's just so rare now. On the other hand, I'm enjoying, I think, a bit more of an integrated experience where I mean, this will make people laugh, but like, you know, I feel like I'm learning how to be in human relationships again, you know, seeing people every day, working with people every day. And I'm really loving that. It's really lovely to be in like healthy relationships with people. Maybe select people. I don't know.
Has it changed your creativity?
I think I feel like I have less time to create now that I'm in this like maybe more busy peopled experience. But maybe not. Maybe I'm drawing maybe now more from, I find myself wanting to write fiction. And so I'm thinking about these fictional characters and inevitably sort of drawing from the relationships with people in my own life. So I think maybe it's inspired me in a different way with like thinking of like human dialogue, because now I have so much more of that in my life, and I'm, you know, encountering more people on a day-to-day basis. So I think it has changed things. I am enjoying it. I am enjoying this transitory sort of period. But I think ultimately, like, I mean, all of us have nature around us, even if we're, I was just in Toronto and I was like marveling. I was right downtown Toronto, but I was right next to this park, and I was like, wow, like, listen to this, to the songbirds, like, you know, even like rising above the sense of traffic, like we all have access to nature. And I think what we can do is really like what the lookout experience taught me is it's just this daily accumulation of observations of the natural world around us. And I think if we can tap into that, even in the tiny bits of nature that are offered to us, and like even in urban landscapes, like we can really build genuine relationships with these natural spaces, you know? And you know, when you observe a thing every day, you start to care about it. And that's what we really need right now, is we need people to care about these natural spaces.
Her latest book is called Lookout, Love, Solitude, and Searching for Wildfire in the Boreal Forest. It's a great read on many levels and a highly recommended Christmas gift for the readers on your list. I look forward to reading Black Bears in 2025. Thank you, Trina.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Bill. I really enjoyed this conversation. Great questions. And I was really happy to do this. So thank you.
That's it for this episode. Thanks to Trina Wells for joining us today. Check out the show notes for more information on her writing and journalism. Thank you for listening to Northern Latitudes. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite platform to stay updated on future episodes. For even more content, including all the Northern Latitudes podcasts, my photography, and Northern Latitudes events, go to northernlatitudes.ca. Theme music and sound logo produced by John Sanfilippo of Soundwise in Kingston. Closing music is called The Cabin in the Woods by Brent Wood. To leave a comment or suggestion, email me at podcast@northernlatitudes.ca. Until next time, I'm Bill Ault. Find your way to Northern Latitudes.